The argument goes, we have a number of very large global businesses in Seattle who have created a remarkably strong economic environment here, but a lot of people have been left out to the point where they're living very visibly in decrepit RVs and ramshackle tents. Therefore, the people who raised the tide without raising all of the ships should be expected to step up, do their part. At least that's how the argument goes. I asked John Kelly, who is Starbucks Senior VP for Global Public Affairs, what he thinks about that premise.
Well, you know, it's obviously it's a complex issue, and we're not experts on homelessness. But look, if I had spent $200 million and the problem got worse, I would look for something else to blame as well. The fact is the city council has spent an enormous amount of money. It has not implemented reforms from its own experts. You know, 2 years ago, Barbara Poppy, who was President Obama's homelessness czar, recommended very clear recommendations to the city council and the city on how to take existing funds, not new funds, but existing funds, and actually solve parts of homelessness within a year. For example, the crisis of unsheltered families. And so our point is simply reform first. Take the recommendations from your own experts. Reform first, show progress, and then consider raising revenue.
The city's approach seems to be housing first, and so they figure they need enough money to either build or subsidize enough housing. I think they're talking about 5,000 people over 5 years or something like that. Is that not the solution?
Well, of course, that's one of the many solutions, but I think the reality is you have to start with the basics, and you have to start with the most urgent crisis and the most vulnerable. The safety net for the most vulnerable children. There are hundreds of children in Seattle that are sleeping in cars at nighttime in a very unhealthy, harmful environment. They go to school during the day, their parents are working, but at nighttime they have no place to go. This is an invisible problem. They're not showing up at city council meetings. This is a constituency here that is about a third of our homeless problem, but they are not a focus of the city council. In fact, last night, I reviewed the Poppy report. Again, this is the city's own recommendations. And I looked at the ordinance and the staff recommendations of how they want to spend this money. And the disconnect between the two of them could not be more clear. In the Poppy report, it talks about an unimaginable crisis, right on page 7. She calls it an unimaginable crisis, which is unique to Seattle. But if you read the staff proposal for spending, you don't see the word families in there. You do see reimbursement for parking violations for RVs and 97 spaces for RV parking, millions of dollars being spent on something that we all agree is not a good solution, but no real focus on families, which is the most obvious, critical, and most vulnerable population. In the meantime, the employer community has raised $6 million and has had more than 2,000, that has moved more than 2,000 family members inside to emergency shelter. That was happening by the employer community with Mary's Place, with United Way, with Wellspring, with great providers as a part of the No Child Sleeps Outside campaign. So the employer community is doing its part to try to address a crisis which we all agree is right in front of us in dealing with the most vulnerable population. The city council, on the other hand, has had 24 months and has not reformed.
Well, you say you've raised $6 million. Nobody I know thinks it could be sold for $6 million. How much do you think it would cost to make sure every child at least is housed?
Well, we think we're in reach. We think it's within, you know, $10 to $12 million
really?
Over the next couple of years to provide emergency shelter. We're not pretending that this solves homelessness. But the thing about families, and again, this is about a quarter to a third of the population out there, and it's a unique Seattle problem. It's not a problem in San Francisco. Even the city of Washington, D.C., of all places, has reduced family homelessness 2 years in a row. But in Seattle, it's getting worse. And it's getting worse because we're not focused on it, as that safety net does not exist.
What would be the first step, then, towards the city council doing something that you could actually support?
Well, I think we'd like to simply follow the three recommendations, which is making families a priority for diversion assistance.
But what does that mean, though? So they make the families a priority. What then changes? Is there a new agency opened up where families could go? Does it mean there's a safe place where a family could park an RV? Does it mean building more housing? What does it mean?
It's allowing service providers like Mary's Place the ability to directly assist without going through the bureaucracy. And it's treating people as human beings.
You're saying it's getting out of the way.
It's getting out of the way, but it's also facilitating because the county and the city, they administer the entry system. And so they have started to move. They're starting to make some progress, but the reality is they're not acting as with a sense of urgency or crisis that it actually.
But I mean, have they been actually telling families no? Family shows up to the existing agency and say, "No, sorry, we have no place for you."
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, this is the crisis, there is not enough emergency shelter.
So they
want to,
they say we have a place for men, we have a place for women, but no place for a family with children.
That has been the situation. It continues. It is getting better because of the No Child Sleeps Outside campaign, but it remains the fact that in Seattle, you do not have a guaranteed place. If you are running from domestic violence or some other circumstance and you have a child, you do not have a guaranteed place for emergency shelter. In fact, you have to wait 180 days just to get access to an emergency shelter. That is insane for a city as compassionate, as progressive as Seattle. And that's what needs to be fixed first before you take on all these other complexities.
John Kelly is Senior Vice President of Global and Public Affairs and Social Impact at Starbucks. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
And that's, I mean, he was pretty upset about that. And a lot of people are, that we appear to be the only city that allows children to sleep outdoors in a tent. Nobody else does this. And we've been fighting this for, what, 20 years, Chris? I mean, how many
at
homeless emergencies are there?
25.
And there's still apparently documented hundreds of children tonight who will sleep in a tent or sleep outside or sleep in a decrepit RV because we have no program for families. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen O'Brien. I don't know if you've seen this, but Working Washington has called for the prosecution of Amazon over its threat to pause construction over this vote on the head tax. In fact, I put up an ad which sort of imitates The Godfather, and it shows a picture of Jeff Bezos and has this little line here. It says, "Nice little city you got there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it." Sage Wilson is with Working Washington. Are you really saying that this is, because actually you are, son. You said this is a criminal offense. You would like to see Jeff Bezos prosecuted for intimidating a public servant. Can you explain that?
The one correction to that is to see the prosecution of the corporate person of Amazon is who would be liable under the relevant RCW. And I think, you know, the facts of what they did are pretty clear, and nobody is really disputing that. They explicitly said that the company was taking an action, that they were pausing construction, they claimed. Although, again, they currently have about 5,000 open positions listed in the city of Seattle. So I think that's whether that pause exists, I think, is an open question. But they said they were pausing, pending the vote. And that's a really key thing, because this was not about, they weren't saying that this was about some speculative consequences if this became law, because in fact, that would be a ludicrous claim, right? This is a company owned by literally the richest person in the world, and this is a tax of about $20 million, right? Like, so they're not claiming that it's the consequences of the law taking effect that will do harm. They are just mad about being told no. They don't want to be told no because they think this is a company town and they're in charge.
Well, and whatever their reasons are, they have a right to say you know if they want to, don't they? And they have a right to move their business. Why would that be a criminal thing?
Because they were aiming it directly at the act of the city council vote itself,
uh-huh.
Right? They weren't like business. We've been through the minimum wage fights and sick days fights and scheduling fights, and businesses always make all kinds of, I think, what in common language would be called threats about supposed consequences if the public of Seattle gets to tell businesses, you know, what we want as the public, lets us run the city via our elected officials. And that's I think can get tedious when they make those kinds of sky is falling threats, but that's par for the course, right? And we, you know, have not suggested that would be a criminal offense. But this is what is fundamentally different about this, again, is what they said was, you can't say no to us. That was the premise of the threat, and that is why it is of criminal nature. Jeff Bezos's wealth alone, last year alone, increased by $30 billion. Increased. Right, and so I think that's why there's such a...
Sage, we all understand that. We all understand
the... That's what makes this be mob boss behavior, because they are saying, I'm in charge, I'm running this place, do what I say or else. just because a company has gotten to be big, that does not mean they get to run the city. The people of the city get to run the city, and the people of the city want something done to get people housed.
Yes. Well, now we're getting somewhere, because you made an argument. We already know how rich Jeff Bezos is, and he doesn't run the city. He has to comply with all the regulations the city imposes, and he has to pay property tax. You're just saying because he's rich, lion's share of the burden of housing the homeless should fall on him. Actually, though, the city has stopped people who want to build cheaper housing from doing it because they make it so expensive to do. They have all this land which is zoned for single-family homes. They have refused to allow micro-housing, which would be a lot cheaper. What about taking the city to task for that?
You know, three or four of the 10, depending where you think Steve Ballmer lives, three or four of the 10 richest people in the world live in King County. And yet all of these giant corporations and all of these 1% of the 1%ers say time and time again that every single different option for actually investing money in addressing income inequality and addressing homelessness is never quite the right one somehow. I think that's a curious pattern, right? Somehow a capital gains tax isn't quite right to them. An income tax, not quite right.
But you keep talking about pouring more money. Where is the money going? How's the money we've already spent? Where is it going?
Where is the $30 billion going? Why is it that when we have so many ultra wealthy people right here, we have this housing crisis? It is income inequality manifesting itself on the streets of our city every day, and something needs to be done about it. The city is saying yes. The people of the city are saying yes. We need to do something about it. And, you know, Jeff Bezos and Amazon are trying to stand in the way of that just because they want to get their way. You know, our main issue here, we think that the groups which and the organizations which build affordable housing and provide services to homeless people know how to do those things that they do. And we are glad to hear what they have to say about how to get that done. What we are saying is that that solution requires a substantial investment of money, and that money needs to be coming from these several hundred largest corporations in the city who can totally afford it. They just don't want to because they think they should be in charge. And, you know, that's not how city politics works. That's how a mob boss runs a company town, but that's not how the city of Seattle is going to work.
Sage Wilson from Working Washington. Thank you, Sage.
Thank you.
I think the mystifies me about the argument is if Amazon pauses construction, why wouldn't they thank them? Since they blame Amazon's construction for causing the housing crisis, now that Amazon's saying we'll pause construction, shouldn't Working Washington say, thank you, thank you?
No, because everybody's too rich and you got to pay. That's the bottom line.
I see.
I like it when you try to ask him questions. He never had an answer other than these people are rich and they need to pay more.
Yeah.
Don't get it.
The latest on this proposal, Mayor Durkan is now out with her own head tax. Among the changes, it cuts the tax in half. And Kai Radio's Hannah Scott has been following this idea and the reaction to it. Hannah.
Dave, details of the mayor's substitute plan for a head tax came out last night before this morning's committee meeting and finance committee meeting, where they're expected to take this up and possibly vote on it. So her plan basically halves the original proposal. Instead of $500 an employee to raise $75 million for homelessness, it would be $250 an employee to bring in around $40 million a year. It also would not convert to a payroll tax in 2021 and instead sunset in 5 years and require renewal to continue, something Durkan made clear to Cairo 7 was a big priority for accountability.
I think it's really important that if we are going to treat homelessness and affordability as a crisis, that we have a period of time in which we gauge our own selves on how we've done. And so I think that there should be a five-year deadline on which any new taxes go. And at that point in time, we should have a review that says, how have we done? Have we moved more people off the street? Have we built more houses? Have we changed all the other resources we're doing to make this a more affordable city?
And while the initial proposal would have used about 3/4 of the money for affordable public housing, the rest for social and homeless services, the mayor's office tells the Seattle Times that she wants the money used for more shelters and services, garbage, waste and needle cleanup, and affordable housing. So it's not clear where the spending priorities would be there. The mayor has been saying that Seattle can't take on homelessness on its own and stressed the need for a regional approach. And her office is now saying they've got some new commitments for money from both the county and the state. including $40 million, the governor says, will go to Seattle and King County this year for opioid treatment, detox facilities, and crisis intervention to address that side of the homeless crisis. And the county executive confirming nearly $6 million from the county this year to expand emergency shelters at two locations in Seattle, and then also to start looking beyond in other places in the county for other opportunities for housing. Now, while some unions have come out in favor of the original proposal, one of the big arguments against it came from construction workers worried about losing jobs after Amazon halted construction on expansion projects in the city over this head tax. Monty Anderson, executive director of the Building Trades Union, says they support this new smaller proposal, though, and Amazon has told them they do too.
To get Amazon on board and have them give me a call and tell me they're going to restart construction is excellent news. I mean, anytime you get a call from an end user or an employer that says they're going to keep and retain hundreds of millions of dollars worth of work, it's good news.
Now, Amazon has not issued an official comment on this new proposal itself, but Anderson says they called him yesterday morning to make the promise that they would resume construction as soon as the smaller head tax proposal clears the full council.
Very clear about that. Very clear. The unpause, the pause button. And like, that's why I'm hoping that everybody at City Council today looks at this as bargaining. When you bargain with your community and your employers and unions, you can get to a middle ground here.
Now, whether that middle ground will come to pass remains to be seen. There's a lot of pressure going into this meeting this morning. The mayor's office says four council members support her smaller head tax proposal. They need five votes on the council for that new version to pass, and the original plan already had support of five council members. So at least one of the five supporting the larger head tax proposal would have to switch sides and now go support the mayor's version. Anderson says he's optimistic.
We have all come together in the middle for a middle plan. So they have to realize what moderation is and get back to the middle and the pulse of the city. That's where I think we're at.
Now, our reporter Mike Lewis is reporting that he's hearing two of the sponsors of the original version may be willing to switch sides here and support some version of a modified version, but nothing there is set in stone yet. One council member not changing position is Councilmember Chama Sawant. In a statement saying this morning, essentially slamming the mayor for doing this, calling it another grim reminder why working people can't rely on corporate politicians. She says it's critical that her movement stand and doesn't do any backsliding on the city council.
When's the next vote on this?
We could see the committee vote today.
Today.
It's possible they're going to have to hammer this out and debate this. She's calling for a big rally there at City Hall this morning with her supporters. Monty will be there as well. And then a full council vote could come next week, but it could also, by Monday at the earliest, could also be delayed a week, depending on how things go today.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Danny, the most remarkable story of the morning, I think, was this one about the deposition of Coach Pete Carroll and GM John Schneider over Colin Kaepernick. And I saw this on NBC. Mike Florio posted had a post here where he said the deposition probably got testy because it likely dealt with whether those two actually believe that the collection of slappies the Seahawks have signed over the past 14 months are truly better than Kaepernick. What do you think's going on here?
Well, Colin Kaepernick's suing the NFL for collusion. That's a very difficult case to prove. And Seattle, as the team that has most openly considered employing him, now twice, they brought him in for a visit last year and were in discussions with him, by all accounts, this offseason to talk to him. They obviously, Pete Carroll and John Schneider, become a big part of why didn't they end up signing him. A little note on Mike Florio: let's not ever mistake him for a journalist. He's not. He runs a website and speaks on NBC, but he's projecting what he thinks happened in a deposition he had no part in. So is there going to be a question of, hey, why did you sign these other players? And that answer, though, here's the interesting. In some ways, Colin Kaepernick's legal team, and this is probably the right step for them to take, are pinpointing and going after the team that has come closest to signing him.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. It sounds like they're punished for at least considering him, which nobody else did.
Right. So that deposition, I don't think there's, unless someone says, hey, yes, we have an agreement among all 32 teams that we're not going to employ Colin Kaepernick. I mean, that's what collusion is. Instead of 32 different teams arriving at the same conclusion, I don't think you can force a team to hire a player if you don't agree with his expressed political message.
Don't you think, though, that Kaepernick's career basically is over with the NFL?
Yes, I do, and I think that's sad. I think he's one of the 60 best quarterbacks in the league on the planet. I think he's one of the 45 or so best quarterbacks on the planet eligible for NFL employment. But if every team looks at it and says, here's what you get for considering bringing in Colin Kaepernick as your coach, and your GM get deposed to explain the logistics of their decision not to employ Colin Kaepernick, yeah, I think I'm beginning to come more and more to the side that his career, his pro football career, is over, which I do think is too bad.
And there's no discrimination case. You're allowed to discriminate against people based on their politics if you want to. It is not a protected class. So
it's not. The weird thing, though, is, Dave, and I would say that this goes for nobody in the NFL will come out and say that. And there's a little bit of this mealy-mouthed, well, and I don't want to completely stick up for Seattle not signing him, because I think they should have. And everybody comes in, oh, it's the right fit, instead of coming out and saying he's going to antagonize 20% of our customers. Mm-hmm. Like, he's going to actively make them mad, and we decided that the benefits of employing him as a backup quarterback aren't worth the attention that it's going to bring to us, and quite frankly, the animosity from a very specific group, and I don't know how large the group is that would be enraged by Kaepernick signing, but it's out there, and I would say it's at least 10%, and probably up to maybe a third, and no one will be honest about that. They just kind of sit and say, like, well, you know, it's a football decision, and we weighed the positives and the negatives, because nobody wants to look like they're choosing not to employ someone because he's standing up in his mind to speak out against the oppression of African Americans.
Danny, do you think then that this lawsuit and this tension between Kaepernick and the NFL, do you think that's going to have any impact on the other players who want to take a stand or take a knee during the national anthem or make their opinions known?
Well, yeah, I do think it will. And you throw in Eric Reed, who is a safety from San Francisco, who's currently not employed as well. I do think it'll have an effect. The other effect that it's had is it's had a very chilling effect and divided some of the players who are very active, because there's a group of the players who were part of kind of the council that talked to the NFL owners about it. They believe that Colin Kaepernick should be in the league, and any conversation about what the league's going to do going forward should start with him getting a job. And others kind of feel like, well, you know, if the owners are going to give us money to help with our social causes, that's a fair trade-off. So yeah, I think Colin Kaepernick, even within the players, is a very divisive issue of some players feeling that they don't know if he really wants to play football anymore, others believing that he's been firmly blackballed and that the players should stand up as a whole and force the NFL to get him a job.
Okay, and let's not forget what the Mariners did last night.
The lefties 1-2 to Seager, swinging a high fly ball deep into right center field. Hernandez going back to the one, he tracked to the wall. Get out the rye bread and mustard, Grandma. It is grand salami time. Kyle Seager with a grand slam with two outs here in the top of the first inning. Holy smokes.
That's all the time we have, but good for them. Thank you,
think
Danny.
It's going to replace John Curley's call of the guy falling off the roof and talking about the salami and rubbing it all over his face?
I don't think anything will ever surpass that.
No.
Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Have a good weekend.
And now your daily dose of kindness. Skip Walter and his wife Jamie were driving home to Bainbridge Island on I-90 when they got into a crash near the summit. Cairo 7's Dee Dee Sun picks up the story from here.
Off-duty firefighter Josh McBride saw the mangled car and pulled over.
He wasn't breathing, unconscious, had a pulse.
McBride cleared the debris from the compartment and lowered this driver's seat back.
At which point he started to breathe again.
More than a month after the crash, 68-year-old Walter is still at Harborview.
I certainly wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Josh.
About 20 minutes after McBride got to the scene, Snoqualmie Fire arrived, and McBride used tools to cut him out.
The entire dash here had been pressed down onto his legs significantly, and so between this and that was trapping him in the vehicle.
Walter's wife was also hurt in the crash, but his brother, son, and daughter came to thank McBride. Walter says he's grateful they were able to find the man who saved his life.
Oh, my God, we're so blessed. because it's so rare that anybody's able to thank an actual individual.
You know, I'm just lucky I had the opportunity to stop and do what I was taught and not screw up. Make the guys proud, I hope.
Skip tells me he doesn't know how much longer he'll have to be at Harborview, but he says he's looking forward to the day he can walk into this fire station, meet Josh, and thank him in person.
Cairo 7's Dee Dee Sun reporting there.
It has become the largest film festival in the United States.
True.
I'm told. 400 movies in 20... Well, it's pretty much a permanent film festival now, isn't it? They got two of their own theaters. At what point did they just become a theater chain?
Well, the thing is, Big Dave, they bring in hundreds of filmmakers and stars, and it is true that SIFF has become much bigger. SIFF now, Seattle International Film Festival, has now have educational programs, vocational programs. It is true. They are a year-round venture, but the festival still is a unique thing of 25 days where they show you, 433 films. Now, that includes a lot of shorts. They're really only 168 full-length features, and there's 66 documentaries and 10 archival prints. But this is like the top of the Mount Everest of a film for the next 25 days. It starts next Thursday. I'm giving you a kind of a preview because you need to start getting into purchasing your tickets. You can go to SIFF.org right now and check things out. The key here, though, is that I have not seen these films either, so these are my hunches. I've pored over the descriptions of all the movies, and based on what I bring to the table in terms of my film knowledge, these are my hunches of some of the films that you might be interested in. But the best thing to do is just go online or go get one of the handouts where they just list all the films and tell you everything about it. So let's start off with one movie I think that'll probably attract a lot of attention is called Won't You Be My Neighbor? Now, I don't know if that line sounds familiar or not.
Mr. Rogers.
You bet. Now, the appeal of Mr. Rogers has always eluded me, but I'm hoping that maybe this documentary will do the trick.
A television program for children made its unauspicious debut on station WQED in Pittsburgh. Its host, Fred Rogers.
You take all of the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite. You have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Low production values, simple set, unlikely star. Yet, it worked.
Now, the film suggests that Fred Rogers related to kids so well because he never forgot his own childhood insecurities. Apparently, he was a sickly child growing up, was often lonely and bullied, and as a result, he kind of empathized with kids because he still sort of felt like that little put-upon kid. And despite his really kind of square 1950s demeanor, I didn't realize that he grappled with a lot of the potent issues of the 60s. The show premiered in the 60s and through the 70s. So he dealt with things like war and racism and divorce and the RFK assassination. So he did grapple with some of the issues. To me, by the time my kids were, growing up, he was as old-fashioned as he seemed, but he actually was very effective at getting across horrific times we were living through to little kids, like five and 6 year olds could relate. And so this movie will sort of finally make me appreciate him. Another movie, this one I'm really looking forward to, it's called Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot. This is a great actor, a great director, and great subject matter. Joaquin Phoenix is the actor, Gus Van Sant's the director, and the subject is John Callahan. I don't know if you ever looked at his stuff, but he was a smart-ass Portland cartoonist and addict who spent most of his life in a wheelchair after this hellacious car accident. I think this looks like a real winner, and in fact, it's the closing night feature of the festival in mid-June.
The last day that I walked, I woke up without a hangover.
Ah, pretty groovy day, huh? I knew I had an hour or so of grace before the
withdrawal symptoms set in.
Keep him coming, bro.
Dexter had mistaken the light pole for an exit and slammed into it at 90 miles an hour.
Don't worry, he won't get far on foot.
Because he's in a wheelchair. See, right. It's kind of a joke. It's part of his sardonic humor. Okay, fair enough. Another movie called Sorry to Bother You. I'm guessing this might be the breakout hit of the festival. Rapper Boots Riley makes his directorial debut with this kind of wacky-looking, high-energy satire about a black telemarketer who becomes phenomenally successful when he discovers his white voice.
Hey, hello. Mr. Davidson, Cassius Green here. Sorry to bother you.
Let me give you a tip. You want to make some money here? Use your white voice.
My white voice?
I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife, like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regal View. as always, we'll be getting that out to you right away.
You're doing so good with the voice thing.
Holla, 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 holla.
So, you see, it's got a great, I don't know if this is going to have kind of like Get Out potential, yeah, you know, to be a breakout hit, but it's a hilarious idea, and I think it's good. One other thing I want to sort of point out, there's a movie called Sadie. Seattle director Megan Griffiths, she's really had an amazing career for somebody who's sort of based here in Seattle. She's got these really remarkably varied films, herring tales about sex trafficking and serial killers to offbeat comedies and slices of life. This latest is a family drama about a troubled 13-year-old girl in conflict with her mother while her soldier father is overseas. The great thing about Megan, I've interviewed her a bunch of times. She's really, you know, friendly and eager to spread the great word about Seattle as a filmmaking haunt. But she often attracts really excellent actors to her projects, like Toni Collette, Johnny Depp, Lou Diamond Phillips. This time she snagged the wonderful Melanie Lynskey to play the mom. I'm really looking forward to that film as well.
All right, so the whole list is at MyNorthWest.com. Tom Tangney, thank you very much.
Very good.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's filling in for Colleen this week. Israel has attacked Iranian forces in Syria. Let's go to CBS News military analyst, retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, who shot first, and is this the opening volley in a wider war?
Well, the Iranians fired first, and they fired low-level ballistic missiles, and really to test, I think, the Israeli defenses along their border there, and that Iron Dome system ended up shooting them out of the sky. But as countries have been warned by Israel before, if you shoot one rocket at them, they're coming back tenfold, and that's exactly what happened. They responded with over 70 missiles fired back inside of Syria at military targets, and the Israelis claim that they've destroyed a significant amount of both Iranian and Syrian military assets, Quds forces. They've destroyed anti-aircraft and defense systems. So it was a very significant response by the Israelis.
I saw some speculation in the New York Times that the reason that Iranian forces decided to fire was because they felt liberated by the fact that the U.S. is dropping out of the Iran deal. Is that true?
I'm not sure how you connect that dot. I think this is a struggle that's taking place inside Iran right now between the civilian leaders and the military leaders and the Quds forces and those that are trying to project Iran's power. And the way that they feel they can do this is by antagonizing Israel inside of Syria, showing that they've got some presence there and domination there. I don't think they're connected at all to this, the U.S. pulling out of the deal. And I think you're seeing the Iranians, though, acting in a manner that hasn't been expected. It wasn't expected by the previous administration as they continue to really become a much more hegemonic power in the Middle East.
You've mentioned before the fact that there are two political currents going on in Iran, these Quds forces, the very conservative Revolutionary Guard, and the rest of the government. But if the Revolutionary Guard is so militarily smart, they must have known that Israel has superior firepower. Now it sounds like they've lost a large chunk of their assets because of this.
That's right. And I'm still questioning as to why they did what they did. And not only did they lose physical assets, but they lost soldiers in this battle. I think this is about them taking the chance and seeing what the response is. And in theory, the Golan Heights is technically not Israel. And they're going to claim that this was something that the Israel breached in terms of international law. I think the Iranians are trying to, you know, lull the Israelis into this fight that the Israelis really don't want to have. Because if they do start it, they're going to absolutely finish it like we've seen them do before in other conflicts. But what I think is going to happen now is this. The Iranians are going to shift now to terrorist tactics. They're going to fund Hezbollah. They're going to go inside of Israel. And you're going to see stepped up terrorist operations inside of the country of Israel itself. And no longer try to deal with these conventional battles that they've been doing.
And a few days on since the decision to drop out of the Iran deal, are we seeing any movement in Iran to reconstitute its nuclear program, or are they hanging back?
They're hanging back. There's not a way they can kind of flip the switch and start that overnight. That's going to take some time. And the bottom line, too, is the deal still stands with those other countries. So if the Iranians decide to enrich uranium and go back to their operations, then they're violating the deal with those other countries. And it shows you what their intent was all along. All the U.S. does is pull out, and now it's going to place sanctions back on Iran. People I've talked to said we should possibly have more things, of, you know, kind of a plan B that follows up besides just the sanctions. But I think we're now in a good wait-and-see period. We'll likely see what the Iranians do. And if they keep maintaining the deal, because they want the deal is in their best interest because they want the economic interest from this, I think that'll dictate as to what those countries will do going forward.
And since I'm always trying to help people win their dinner table arguments, either one way or the other, as long as we use facts here, is it fair to say that all the predictions that the sky would fall if the president pulled out of this deal, that has turned out to be not true?
That's not true, Dave. The sky is not going to fall anytime soon. This is third-dimensional chess on multiple different levels. What the United States did by pulling out of this deal is this. We've aligned ourselves with countries in the Middle East, the Israelis and the Saudi Arabians, inside of the countries there by, let's say, turning our back on the European allies. These are European allies that, frankly, have their own internal problems. All they cared about in this deal was the economic value they were going to get for their countries. And right now, we've got to look forward toward security. I don't think the Germans, nor the French, nor even the British can care that so much about that, as they have got their own internal immigration problems themselves.
Are the European allies going to try to circumvent our imbibe? We're imposing more sanctions. Are they going to try to circumvent them by acting as go-betweens, and do we then punish them for that if they do that?
Well, what we've been told is they've been told to have their companies shut down businesses with the Iranians right now. You saw a message that came from the German ambassador that said that German companies should start thinking about winding down their operations inside of Iran. I can tell you this. There's tremendous amount of influence that those countries have in the Middle East. They build their roads. They build a lot of their construction. So, that's going to be the issue, is they're not going to go after the countries themselves, but we're going to go after companies. One of the major things is Airbus. Does the Airbus contract still stand? Will the U.S. sanction Airbus and shut down the Iranians from international banking relationships because of this deal? That still remains to be seen.
CBS military analyst and retired Army major Mike Lyons. Mike, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.